I'm David, compulsive overeater, and very happy to be here. So it's so surprising because I really didn't think I'd know anybody but Joe. And I look around and there's people I'm very close to and people I've known from the beginning and people I've done service with and people I've seen from conventions. So it's just, it's really amazing. That's what's amazing about this program. You never know what to expect. And I thought nobody would know my story. And there's people I don't know. So I'm going to try and do a little of tell you what it's like now, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But I do want to start with today and tell you what my day is like and how I live my life today and then sort of go back. Joe, how much time do I have so I can sort of plan? I couldn't. You muted
yourself, Joe. There you go.
45 to 50 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow.
You have the whole hour.
I'm not used to this. Okay. So, definitely want to tell you what it's like. First of all, I'll just real quick, just tell you the quick stats. I came into OA. I went to my first meeting in 1973 when I was 12 years old, when my mom forced me to go to a few meetings with her, and I wanted nothing to do with you people. And I'm fat and I love food, but I'm not like you. I never could do this thing. I could never, there's no such thing as a higher power. And all these old people, you know, in their 40s that now young enough to be my kids, but they were old people at that time. And I didn't want anything to do with it. Anyway, I started. My mom had a comeback in 1976 and convinced me to go to a teen meeting in June 1976. And I haven't stopped coming to OA since then. I was 16 years old at the time. I'm now 61. So I came in as a teenager and I'm now a senior citizen. So I know the spectrum of different life experiences in this program. I know what it's like to live at home with my parents. I know what it's like to live away at college. I know what it's like to live as a single person. I know what it's like to be in a relationship. I know what it's like to be newly married, have kids, and now being a half of an empty nester. So I know all the different aspects of life in OA. So today I was invited. What I do for a living is I manage a bank, and part of, because of the experience, and I think it has a lot to do with all the OA service I did, but I'm very active in the community where I work, and more as that happens, I keep getting invited to join other organizations, and some of the customers that they give me as my personal clients are like a couple of museums and nonprofits, and it's very strange because I never did service for what I would get personally out of it, but it seems like things come full circle. And there's a museum that's my client, and they invited me to a lunch today and to hear a speaker speak about the Cultural Revolution in China. It's a Cold War museum in Culver City, if anybody knows the LA area. And I didn't think I would know anybody other than the person who invited me, which was the CEO of this museum, and maybe the accountant who I deal with on her banking. And it was a last minute thing. And I just, you know what? I just say yes. I had nothing to do today. I mean, I had nothing else that urgent. And I went and I just talked to people and I didn't freak out, you know, and I knew what to say to people. And they had a buffet lunch and I took a plate and I was fine. And they had food that I was appropriate. And I sat there and I worked for a bank that one of their niches is they have a lot of Chinese employees and they do a lot of cross-border things with China. And I know very little about China. And this museum, this exhibit, and the speaker was all about something I really was so interesting to me on the history I don't know. And I was just, and even after many years in OA, I was still like, David, you were so afraid of people. I couldn't go to school because I would be so afraid of having to talk to fellow classmates. I would just be, or recess would come and I would be like so much wanting to just blend into the walls because I was afraid of people. And here I can go to an event that if for the lunch part, there was only like maybe 30 people. And these were all like CEOs of other museums or companies or foundations. And I'm there and I'm not an outgoing person. I'm still a little bit reserved and whatever, but I can just, I learned in a way that all I have to do is put one foot in front of the other and just take the first step. I don't have to know everything. I don't have to be the center of attention. I don't have to be anything. I just, if it's appropriate, if it works out, just show up to life. You know, somebody, when I was growing up, I just loved to sit in my room, watch TV and eat that and do jigsaw puzzles. That was the, you know, just isolate. And because the world was a scary place and people were scary. And there's still that feel. I mean, it isn't like, you know, I'm sure, you know, it doesn't change it, but I just walk through those fears anyway. And then the fears aren't that bad. And I don't have to eat over it. And I can abstain one more day and I could see the joy. After this event, I just had a very short time. I usually on the weekends, especially Sundays, we babysit my daughter's dog when her and her boyfriend both work. And so usually I take the dog and my son for a little hike or whatever. And so because of the timing and stuff, I didn't have time to do it. And there's a place right near there that has these steps. And it was like a 25-minute walk up and down. And it has this beautiful view. Today, it's been a very clear day in LA. And I was able to see downtown Los Angeles. And that's what I was able to do. And physically, when I was growing up, I had all my weight was in my stomach and I couldn't walk. And my thighs would rub together and burn. You know, I always had blisters on my thighs and my pants would rub out because how my legs would rub together. And I had bad asthma and had trouble breathing. So walking and especially hiking or going up steps, I couldn't do things like that. And here I can do things. I don't exercise compulsively, but I do something every day. I try and do something every day consistently, something, if you know, and take care of myself physically, and to be able to at my age be healthy, you know, and physically active and you know, I have some health challenges I'll talk about in a little bit, but that I can do it It's because of this program. If I wasn't in this program, I have a younger brother, 5 years younger than me. And growing up, he was tall and I'm short and he was thin. He was underweight. His biggest problem was because he was athletic, he was always trying to gain weight. And so I hated him. I mean, I hated that aspect of my brother growing up. And he was, as a kid, he was very, because he was the baby, so everybody loved him and he got all this attention and he was thin and could eat, you know, he wanted to fatten himself up and everybody else did it. And with me, everybody's trying to get me to lose weight. And I always judged myself against him and felt so bad. And because of this program, I've learned with all my family members to have a good relationship. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes too. But me and my brother are very close. And I look at him now and he's not very overweight, but he is overweight. And when I come visit or when he comes here, he'll take walks with me or do things. But my nephew, his son was visiting a few weeks ago and said, you know, Uncle Dave, and he wanted to go hiking to see the Hollywood sign. So I took him and my kids, and he was saying, how come you don't get my dad to walk? All he does is sit around. He doesn't take care of himself. That when he went for a walk with us last time, he was out of breath. David, how come you can't get my dad to do like you do? And one thing is, I know I can't control anybody. I can only pray for my brother. I can try and set an example. I can try and set an example for my kids, for my nephew, my niece. But like, who knew that I would be the one later in years that would be healthy? Again, it's a miracle of this program, and that I've kept coming back, because that was not the direction I would go. I've been in OA as I just said, all these years. I guess it's 47 years. Over 47 years. And it's one day at a time. I'm still a compulsive overeater. You know, my first reaction after lunch is, maybe I need seconds. Maybe it's not enough. Or, you know, I didn't have time for breakfast because it was an early thing today. And after I did everything, you know, maybe I'll need to eat an extra meal today. Or what, I mean, because that for me, I'm not cured of compulsive overeating. But by being in this program, it just, I don't want to hurt myself with food. And I just, abstinence is eating in a way that I'm not hurting myself, and that I'm maintaining the weight that I maintain. And I've, for many, many, many years, have been within about a 5-pound range, the same weight and the same size, almost since right after college. I've had the same size. What I was going to say. Every day I have to meditate. You know, even there's no vacations. My sponsor always reminds me, you know, that there's no vacations from program. And so whether I'm home, whether I have a busy day like I had today, you know, I time at least 5 minutes. For me, that's a lot, to that minimum. And usually I said 10 or 15, but it's a minimum of 5 minutes to sit on my couch, read the two OA books, say the Serenity Prayer, and say the first three steps. I say it over food. I say it over my work. I say it over my family. I say it over my health, sometimes over politics. If I'm getting a little crazed about politics, if I'm getting crazed about COVID, I say the first three steps on those things to help me get through the day. And when I'm really crazy, then I go really in specific. So when I say I admit it, I'm powerless over work, and I'm powerless over this person at work and that person, I'm powerless over this deal going through, and I'm powerless over this reception we're planning, you know, and if I'm having trouble with food, it's, you know, I'm powerless over food. I'm powerless over my weight. I'm powerless over what I'm going to have for dinner tonight, you know, if I have to. And I did for many years with my family. I had an aunt that was estranged. She was the only close relative. She was my only blood aunt or uncle left. And she just disappeared from her daughter. One day, her daughter called her to say that her ex-husband had a stroke and she needed her mother's help. And her mother said, I'll call you. And I didn't know that that had happened, but I called her to say, my niece was born and we're going to be flying to Arizona to see my brother and see the new baby. Does she want to come with us? And she goes, you know, I think I have a sick friend, but I think maybe I'll come with you. And she disappeared. She didn't talk to any of us for about 10 years. And I started in the morning on my daily meditation to turn her over. And I was powerless over finding her, knowing if she was alive or not, what have you. And about 12 years ago, my wife bumped into in a market that she never shops in a part of the city that she never goes to. And there was a time my aunt wound up living with us for almost a year. So you never know, but it was all turning, you know, just that's how I live my life. That, you know, the steps, working the steps in every area and turning it over. Let me go back a little bit more into my story and a little bit more details. I am the type of compulsive overeater that I think I was from the chute going out. I was always a fat, I was a big baby, and it never stopped. And I always thought of myself as big. When I was growing up, they'd say, "You're going to be a football player. You're so big," you know. And it's hard because I'm about 5'7", 5'7" and a half at the most, and really I'm sort of average stature. But I think of myself even today as being a big person, because that's how growing up people talked about me. And because I was heavy from as a baby, I was just a big kid. I wore, at 10 years old, my mom was buying me adult sizes. I think I wore I wear a size 34 now. And as a kid, I think at 10 years old, I was already at size 36. And the doctors were saying, you know, I was going to be 250 pounds by the time I was in high school. And I just loved food. Food was the only thing. I was a very depressed, and I think some of it was genetics or in my makeup. I suffered from a lot of depression as a kid. And food was the only thing that would get me through life sometimes. When there would be school events, it was sometimes only looking forward to what the food would be there to get me to go. And even in nursery school, I can remember the days, if they only at snacks served crackers, I'd be upset. But if they served like cookies or something exciting, then I was like really excited for snack to come, and I would be in a good mood. So I know I've always been a compulsive overeater. I come from a Jewish family that wasn't very religious, but culturally everything was about food, and love was about food. My father was a Holocaust survivor who lost, you know, he had a sister, one sister die in the other sister's arms of starvation during a death march when they were liberated from the concentration camps. And my dad saw people die of starvation in the camps with him. And then he went to Israel, where things in the 40s and 50s were very, very scarce. Food was scarce. He used to have to take a chicken in his motorcycle. He had one surviving sister and three nephews, and he would drive them for Friday night meals. He would have to take that one chicken to them so there would be food for the family. So that's on my dad's side. And on my mother's side, her parents, she was born in New York, but her parents came from Russia, and they came from pogroms and starving. And later my grandmother died when I was a baby. And so my grandfather came to live with us, and he wasn't fat, but he was also a compulsive overeater, always into food. And always him and my mother were always like over buying, over making sure that there was always food, because it was like they thought the Russian army was going to come visit us and they have to have enough food to feed them all. That was always, there was the cabinets. It was only, you had, if the cabinets, every cabinet wasn't filled with food, like every cupboard, there wasn't going to be enough. And that's that, you know, and I picked it up. And I want to say it's because I'm a compulsive overeater. My brother was born in the exact same environment. And he didn't pick that. He picked up other crazy stuff, but he didn't pick up the foods, that kind of food stuff. You know, he didn't pick up the compulsive overeating like that. But I did. It just, that stuff, I took it, that food was important, and food was how I felt love, and food was how I felt okay, and food is what filled the boredom. That was the biggest thing, and feeling horrible about myself, because everybody else, I didn't do particularly well in school I didn't have friends. I didn't know how to talk to people. And so I only had food to comfort me and to fill up. I just felt like there was this hole inside and I just, there's nothing that could fill it. And so I, of course, I needed to eat. And I didn't realize it, of course, growing up. And I just thought I'm fat. I'm just born, like I have brown eyes and brown hair. I'm born fat. That's what I thought. And I didn't believe in God. My parents, despite what they went through, my dad, he said he believed in God. My mother, she didn't until when she went to OA, and then she became sort of fanatical about God and stuff like that. But I was too smart for that. And, you know, there couldn't be a God if all these bad things happened. And I felt I had to fix the world. You know, the world was on my shoulders. To jump again ahead to forward, you know, I told you I manage a bank. I'm on the board of a lot of organizations, a lot of community things. Sometimes the world really is on the outside, could seem like it's on my shoulders, you know, and program gives me that it's not, it's all an illusion, you know, and I don't have to, even though whatever my job is, my position is, all my real job is doing what my higher power wants and showing up to life and doing the best job I can. And the same with being a parent. Sometimes as a parent, you know, I can feel like, oh my God, I don't give my kids enough direction, or I don't control them enough, or I should do more this, that. But program reminds me I'm not in charge. You know, I'm not God anymore. I've given up that role for the most part. That's the way I grew up, the way my head thought of what I thought my job was in life. It's gone. I have a good relationship. I want to go back about my family. You know, my brother had three parents, my mom and dad and me. I was 5 years older, and he was one of the people I tried to control, you know, and thought it was my job to fix everything that was wrong with him. And he was hyperactive and he had a lot of issues. Even in program, I still had trouble letting go of not telling my brother what to do and how to live his life. And over the years of working my program, going to meetings, hearing how other people dealt with their family, their relationships, people who had children, and at that time I didn't, I learned that, you know what, my job is, if my brother doesn't ask me, I don't tell him how to live his life. If he asks a question, I tell, you know, give him my opinion if it's appropriate. I can be, my brother's not in any program, but I can be an example of the big book by the way I live my life. And that's how I look at it in my relationship. So I don't, and a few times I did things that I had to make amends to my brother, telling him what I thought he should do. When he got married, I told him he should have had my father at the head table, and we had a big blowout on there with his now ex-wife, we did. And I learned, you know, I'm not perfect. Even in program, I make mistakes, but I learned that I stopped trying to fix him and to be, you know, his higher power, and trust that he has his own higher power. His kids have their own higher power. And me and my brother are really close. You know, when my parents both died fairly young, he was in his early 30s, I was in my mid 30s. We became even closer. And my nephew and niece, they all the time, they want to come from Arizona, even as little kids, they would fly them unaccompanied minors so they could spend time with us. And we do a lot of vacations together, and we just have a really good relationship. And if I wasn't in program, if I wasn't abstaining, if I didn't have the steps, I wouldn't have the skills. I didn't have the skills. The way my life was going, I wouldn't be able to be the type of person that could have a relationship. And what that did was, his ex-wife was really crazy, and I won't take her inventory, but she was really crazy. And I learned to just bite, I would talk to my sponsor about it and bite my tongue, because I wanted a relationship with my brother. And so I didn't say anything. And then when they got separated, my brother could come to me and didn't have all that baggage and just tell me all the stuff and even say, you know, when Tammy would have a meltdown in front of you and, you know, when she did this, it was so embarrassing and all the stuff, because I didn't kept giving him my opinion. I was a safe space to come to when the shit hit the fan, you know, and then I could say to him, yeah, you know, this stuff. And the same now with my nephew and niece, is they're 20 and 22, and they're able to come to us and tell us stuff about their mom. And we don't have to say, oh yeah, we'd never say anything bad about her, but they can come to us and tell us, you know, what they're going through. And they've had some really difficult stuff with her. And we can have her. She, sometimes the whole family comes for holidays. We've tried to be so the family, so my nephew and niece don't have to choose sides. So there's times that we invite all of them to certain things, and it's, we can do it, you know, and have that. And I, you know, it's a miracle of this program. With my parents, you know, that was the biggest amends I had, you know, coming into OA young, I didn't have a lot of overt things that I did that I needed amends, but one of the biggest ones was with my parents. And even the first few years and when I lived at home, I just hated them. I just, everything they did pissed me off. And I remember reading in the, was it in the big book, or people saying, oh, if you hate somebody, it's because something you hate in yourself. And I remember telling my sponsor, what bull crap, you know, especially my mom. She was so opposite of me, other than being a compulsive reader, but she was loud and in your face, and she'd have meltdowns, and I, none of that I did. You know, I was a quiet person. I never was confrontational, things like that. So I'm like, bullshit. You know, she pushes my buttons because she's, and then my sponsor said, but it is because of you. It's because she's opposite of you, and that, and she scares you. She scares you what you don't want to be. And it is about you. And my sponsor would say, take responsibility for you. If you keep putting the blame on your parents and your mom for your problems, you'll never recover. You will not get ahead if you base your recovery on fixing them or them being better. You don't have a chance. And he made me always focus on me and taking my inventory and working my steps and looking at my character defects and my amends. And it wasn't until I moved out of my parents' house, lived on my own for a while, that my sponsor later said, you know, it really, you were in a really bad environment. It's a good thing you moved out. And, but that's, it taught, but having the focus on myself, and it really taught me that that's what this program is about. It's not about placing blame on the world or looking for the world fault. And so I can talk about the stuff that, you know, my background and what happened and my parents' stuff with food, and not put them on the blame for where I'm at today. Anyway, I learned to have a relationship. I learned to do living amends. I would go to my parents on Sunday and have dinner almost every Sunday with them and listen to my dad tell stories about his life experience. And never, with my mother, she was very sick, and she died at 66. And that was, she was at 40, told she'd probably not live more than a few years. She had diabetes and high blood pressure and had been at one time obese. And so with her, it wasn't a surprise she died young. But my dad, he died 3 years later. He had lung cancer, and we didn't know it until a week before he died. Because he kept working until a few weeks before he died. And he just didn't take care of himself. But especially after, with my dad, when I was young, and he would drive me to OA, and he'd say, why do you have to go to those OA meetings? And I say, Dad, we talk about our problems, we discuss things, so we don't have to eat over it. And he said to me, you have problems? And I knew what he meant, you know? And in his eyes, what problems did I have living a middle-class, working-class life? You know, what problems? He couldn't relate. He couldn't understand. He couldn't understand if I would disagree with him politically, you know, because he lost his his dad when he was like 12, 13 years old. So he couldn't understand a relationship. But program helped me learn to just, you know, I think it was either my sponsor or somebody said, just go have dinner with your dad. And I started, this was when I think I first moved out of the house without my mom. I just went out to dinner with my dad. And I had nothing to even talk about because we just politically and looked at the world so different, you know. And he wanted, I wasn't even working, but he wanted me to be self-employed like he was, or he just didn't understand me working for a big company and just everything. He just didn't agree. So, but I just learned to find things in common and spend time with him. And then when my mom died, by that time, I had become his best friend. And we went to Israel together after I went once with both my parents. And then I went with my dad and we went back to where he was born and to Budapest, where he had spent time after the war. And it was just like, and I had no idea he would die that young. But it's just, we had a complete relationship. And both funerals of my parents, it was the same rabbi. He'd say, you know, if you want to say, when everybody left the chapel, he'd say, if you want to say you're sorry, you know, to the immediate family, to your departed relative, this is the time to do it. And honestly, I had nothing. I had made all my amends while they were alive, you know, and that's a blessing of this program, that I was complete with them, you know, and that's how I can do relationships. I can, with my kids, I have two very different kids. I have twins that just turned 25, and I have a son that's autistic and still lives at home and is like the maturity of a maybe young teenager, and a daughter who's 25 and, you know, very out there in the world and doing, you know, well for herself. And I can be there for both of them in different ways and be an example. And both of them through their lives. And I think some of it is because I'm still a compulsive overeater and they either genetically picked it up from us or, you know, a household that we think about food or we still probably reward too much with food. They both on different times have had issues with weight or whatever. And I never had to do what my parents, I never had to shame them, never had to say this or that, you know, and I would just talk about healthy, you know, and they've both found their ways, whatever it is. And my daughter is really into fitness now and eating healthy, and I don't have to, and she's all the time like, Dad, I eat this, or I'm doing this, what do you think of this? You know, she's seeking my advice often, and I don't have to push. And my son being autistic, it's a whole other thing with him. We have to sometimes tell him because he doesn't understand portions and stuff like that. So that's a whole other thing. And sometimes too, sometimes his overeating is because of his, I think, neurological issues, but it's a mirror to me because sometimes the way he eats, I could see myself as a compulsive overeater. And sometimes I have to be careful of the buttons he could push. But I have because of this program has taught me how to love myself and accept myself and be with myself, I can be there for them. I'm still a person, and especially, you know, I have a job that I'm around people and I do all these community things and I'm around people a lot, but I'm a person that I sometimes need my own time. I am definitely not one that I can't be around people all the time. And this program has helped me learn to accept who I am and balance it. But it's because I can give to myself. Even when my kids were little, I still made sure I went to at least 3 meetings a week and that I made time to meditate in the morning and that I call my sponsor at least once a week. And I I would go to the gym a few days a week. I remember I found that certain gyms had kids club, and I could take my kids so they would do something. They would think I'm taking them to this fun place, but I could also still take care of myself. And me and my wife would, Saturday night, we always had a babysitter when they were young, and that was our date night. So we had our balance. And that's another thing I learned in the program is I need to be there for myself. I need to be there for other people. I need to have that kind of balance. And that's really helped me. About a higher power. I learned, you know, when my life, in a way, after it took about a year, but I saw what a difference OA was making in my life, that it was, I had one of these thunderbolt experiences where how could there not be some kind of higher power? If somebody who never had friends hated themselves so much in a year, I was losing weight. I had a group of friends in OA at that time. I didn't love myself, but everybody was telling me how much they loved me at meetings. Like I was on a pink cloud that first year. And there had to, I knew there, it wasn't that anybody told me, it wasn't a rabbi telling me this or that. It was the lived experience that all of a sudden I was driving to a meeting with a bunch of friends. And it's like, there has to be some, I don't know what it is, but there is a force that has completely changed my life. And sometimes, you know, I still, like, I don't know, is there really a God? Is it all in my imagination? But I act as if I pray and meditate every day anyway. And other times I get these strong signals. You know, I go, the bank had made a donation to the LA Holocaust Museum, and I made an appointment to give them, to take a tour to thank them, so they could thank our bank for the donation. And they show me this wall of videos. And they say, you know, everybody who's a Holocaust survivor, there's like 40,000 of them, you know, in a year, if your dad was a survivor, twice a year, he's up there. And near the end of the tour, randomly, he was up on the wall. It's like, it was, they started crying, I started crying. It was just like, I don't know, is that God? Is that just a big coincidence? But all of a sudden, now I'm very active in the Holocaust Museum. It was like a sign to get involved with that organization. You know, I live my life that I choose to believe that there's some kind of power that creates things like that in my life. Just like today, saying yes, I would go to this luncheon, and it was just, you know, for me, very, very rewarding that I went to hear about the Cultural Revolution that I would have never known anything about if I hadn't gone to, if I hadn't been willing to go today, you know.
10 minutes, David.
Okay. You know, in 19, I really wasn't involved in much organized religion after I came to OA. I mean, I used to go to synagogue for high holidays and and stuff. But anyway, in 1984 is when I graduated college, and my godfather, my dad's cousin, died, who I was very close to. And at the funeral, the rabbi just spoke to me, and it wound up, I started going to his synagogue. And a lot of my dad's cousins belonged to that same synagogue, so my dad would sometimes go with me. And then when my mother died, we started going together every Friday night for her. And then when my kids were born, and so we became very involved. And then later when my kids got a little older, we joined a synagogue that had things for things. And now I'm on the, you know, I'm very active. That's another community that we're so involved. We have some of our closest friends are part of this synagogue. Both me and my wife are on the board. I'm the treasurer. We're active. We go every Friday. We either have a people over for a Shabbat dinner or we go to services. You know, I learned in a way to take, I don't have to be very religious, but I take what I like and leave the rest. And for me, it's very meditative. I have a very stressful job, a stressful life sometimes. And Friday nights, I can just disconnect for 1 hour while I'm there. And the songs and the prayers, and it's very spiritual. And often we have people, less during the pandemic, but it's coming back again, where we have people at our house, and it just fills me with spirituality if I can share a meal with people, you know, and share that peacefulness of Friday night, just the ending of the week with friends and or family, you know, and I feel so blessed. And again, I would have never been like this without the program. I'm blessed. I want to talk a little bit about absence. My absence is, at the beginning, it was just calling in what I was going to eat. Later, it started being a certain amount of calories. And basically, three meals a day. I'm very flexible on what and how I eat. I used to, before the pandemic, go to the gym after work, you know, like 3 days a week. And so I would have a handful of almonds or a piece of fruit or something, you know, before I'd go to the gym. And for me, that's part of my dinner. That's part of being flexible, but that's part of my absence. But it's not, I can't just have whatever I want, you know, or I don't have an extra meal. It's what I do or you know, if I'm cooking, I taste what I'm eating, and that it works for me. I have a certain amount of food that I know that keeps me in my weight and in sane thinking, sane eating. And I know everybody, and I remember I used to hear Joe speak and talk about how everybody's absence has to work for them. And I still remember that sometimes. And for me, especially with my job, I have a lot during the week. There's a lot of either lunches or receptions I go to, or sometimes dinners. And I just I just sometimes don't know if they're going to serve enough to make it a dinner. Is it just going to be appetizers? Is it going to be food I really can't have? And I just will have something to drink and eat dinner when I come home. And I'm grateful that for my lifestyle and my absence, you know, I can have that kind of flexibility. And I check in with my sponsor. And sometimes it'll get to my head, and I'll call my sponsor and say, you know, it's really to go to something where they were passing appetizers. I think I ate very, you know, moderate, but I don't know. And I can just say it like it is, and then, you know, go on. And be blessed that I can have this rich life, and the food is not the center of it. One thing my sponsor kept saying is, if you get into the people, you'll get out of the food. And that's something I've really seen the longer I'm in program, because I was so isolated before program, and that was so much part of my disease that I needed the food. And the more I've let people in my life, the easier absence has been in that way. You know, I remember we went to Las Vegas, and buffets are something I don't do buffets too often, because it's still to this day, it would be too, it's hard if I do it too often. And I remember meeting my dad's cousins wanted to go to a buffet. And they were just very friendly, and they started talking. And I remember not finishing half my meal because they were so busy asking us about the kids and this and that, and just talking so much. And I remember calling my sponsor and said, oh my God, you know, it really is true. I was so busy talking to them and enjoying their company that it was a miracle that I just wound up eating moderately at this buffet. And it's funny. And that was another thing about showing up and giving service. My cousins, their daughters that I'm pretty close to, said, you know, my parents feel closer to you than some of their nephews and nieces. Every time you go to Las Vegas, you spend time, you visit them every time you do that. Their own nephews and nieces, you're a cousin, and nephews and nieces don't even come see them. And they just feel so close to you. And it's like that, some of the, see, I always thought that there was a secret rule book to life. And all of these things, like just doing the appropriate thing, giving service like that, just to, you know, see people, has been the rule book that I was always looking for, you know. And it's listening to meetings, it's still coming to meetings and hearing how everybody else lives their life, that has helped me learned to live my life. So I think I feel like I'm done. I very seldom talk this long. So anyway, again, Joe, thank you for asking me to share.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. I will mention that David was on the Board of Trustees for, I know, at least 6 years, and he was chairman of the board. And he was on the board when I was, and we were the ones that passed the first OA 12 and 12. And so David did a lot of service, and I think that I know service has helped me, and I think it will help anyone on this meeting if they can do service at their intergroup, at their meeting, at World Service, at Region, or whatever. Just do service. And I know I'm looking over here and I'm seeing people like Wanda and Mike and Lee and other people that have all been in service at above the group level. And I know that they have all benefited from it.